Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning. This has been the case for the past 6 years, although we've only got one more week of doing the morning broadcast. Now, if you haven't heard the announcements earlier this month, we're not going off the air. We're just changing our time frame. We're not going to be on from 9:30 to 10 in the morning as we have been for the past 6 years. We're going to be on from 2 o'clock to 2:30 in the afternoon. In fact, just to help our listeners get used to that, we're already on from 2 o'clock to 2:30 in the afternoon, as well as the morning broadcast. So we're having this transitional month, all the month of December. We're on in the morning and in the afternoon. Remember, we're not just replaying the same program. These are live broadcasts, so it's different callers, different questions, different subject matter in the afternoon than in the morning. It's not like listening to, say, Charles Stanley twice a day where it's the same broadcaster, J. Vernon McGee. This is a live program, and therefore you get different content in the morning and in the afternoon. But we will have one more week next week between Christmas and New Year that we will be on in the morning, and after that we'll only be on at 2 in the afternoon. So I hope you'll be making a note of that. Some of you, I hope, have already formed the habit of tuning in at 2 o'clock. That's why we're doing it both times this month. So you can form that habit, and we can hit the ground running on Monday, the 2nd of January, with everybody on board in the afternoon. So we are on both right now, but we'll only be on in the afternoon beginning, not Monday, but a week from Monday. All right, now I'm going to give you a phone number because the program is live, as I said, and you can call in with your questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, and that's what we're here for. Or you can call in to express an alternative viewpoint different from that of the host. Feel free and welcome to do that. The number to call is 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Michael calling from Norwalk, California. Michael, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Steve. I'm just calling to ask about the 400 years of silence between the Old Testament and New Testament. I guess I kind of want to know why might it have been 400 years, but mainly, does that have anything to do with numerology, like, you know, the 40 days and 40 nights and then the times 10 or anything like that?
You know, I don't know that anyone would say it's exactly 400 years. 400 is a rounded-off number. It is roughly 400 years between Malachi and Matthew. The truth is no one knows exactly when Malachi was written, but it was written approximately 400 years before the coming of Christ, and therefore we just speak of it in shorthand as 400 years. Interestingly enough, there was also 400 years that we speak of Israel's captivity in Egypt. They probably were not there exactly 400 years, but it's interesting that the same number is given. Now, that may be not significant in the least, but it is interesting to me, whether significant or not, as far as whether God counts it significant or not, it's interesting to me that the Exodus took place after 400 years of God's silence to Israel in Egypt. God had been speaking to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but then there's this period in Egypt, and at the end of that, God sends Moses, the deliverer, and enters into a covenant with the people and saves them from their bondage. Well, there was approximately 400 years of silence before Jesus came, and when he came like a second Moses, he made a covenant with the people and delivers us from our bondage, our spiritual bondage. So it may be that there's significance there. However, I would point out again that we don't know that it was exactly 400 years in either case. And therefore, you know, I wouldn't make more of this than is justified, I'd hope. In any case, the 400 years of so-called silence weren't entirely silent, because we do have historical information about those years, what God was doing in Israel. Some important things were happening in Israel, including the Maccabean revolt and the Maccabean victories, which led to the rededication of the temple in 166 or so B.C., And of course, that's celebrated this time of year by the Jews with Hanukkah. That event took place during that 400 years that we call the silent years. We call them silent only because there were no writing prophets. God was not speaking to Israel through prophets, at least not much, and none of them were writing. So we have no writings from prophetic authors between Malachi and the time of course, the Gospels, which is about 400 years. But God did, of course, work with the people of Israel. And there may have been people who prophesied. For example, we know that before Jesus came to his public ministry, before John the Baptist began to preach, there was someone like Simeon, an old Israeli man in the temple, whom God had spoken to and told him that he would not die before he sees the Messiah. That would be a prophetic word. And that was given apparently before Jesus was born. And so when Jesus was born and came to the temple, acting upon that word that he had received from the Lord, Simeon came and, of course, rejoiced to see Jesus and said, now I can die in peace. Likewise, John the Baptist's father, Zechariah, or as he's called in the New Testament, Zecharias in the Greek form of his name, he prophesied too. So the spirit of prophecy was not entirely absent, but there were no writing prophets during that time. So as far as the Bible is concerned, that's a silent period. And, as far as the number 400, I don't know if it's related to the number 40, which is a significant number in Jewish numerology, but it could be. I wouldn't deny it. I just couldn't affirm it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Michael. I appreciate your call. God bless you. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. Let me give you the phone number because we have lines open for you right now. And I realize a lot of you are busy making final preparations for Christmas. Well, Christmas Eve is tomorrow and Christmas the next day, so I realize you're very busy, but feel free to call. We only have a half hour set aside for this, and we have lines open for you at 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Don from Poulsbo, I think it's called, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Poulsbo, Washington. He said, I have a question I've not been able to answer to my satisfaction concerning our Lord's physical body. Where did it go when he was able to appear and disappear and apparently pass through physical barriers? It seems his body was not totally physical, although he was able to consume food, which he couldn't have done if it was a less than physical body. But when he ascended into the sky, how could that have been a physical body, and where did it go? That is, where did his physical body go? Well, Don, these questions we can try to answer, but we're not given an answer biblically. That is, we don't have the scripture answering those questions. And we can only make certain deductions which may approximate the truth, or we might miss it by a mile. The impression I have is that when Jesus rose from the dead, unlike people who had risen from the dead before him, like Lazarus, or Jairus' daughter, or others who had been brought back to life from the dead, Jesus was glorified. These previous people that Jesus himself had risen from the dead, or had raised from the dead, and even Elijah and Elisha in the Old Testament had raised people from the dead, these people were simply brought back to life. They weren't glorified. Jesus is the first fruits of those who slept, the firstborn from the dead, in the sense of the new creation, the glorification of the body. In fact, it says in Philippians that in the end of the age, when Jesus comes back, that he'll change our vile body into the likeness of his glorious body. So there's a change in form. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, there is no 17 in Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 15, he says that this mortality, meaning our mortal bodies, will put on immortality. And this corruptibility, which means subjection to decay, will put on incorruptibility, not being subject to decay. He says our bodies will be sown in weakness, but they're raised in power. They're sown in dishonor, he means buried, but they're raised in glory. So Jesus' body, and ours eventually in the resurrection, are glorified. What does that mean? Well, we're not told exactly what that means, but we have only anecdotal information. That's what you're asking about. And it's very difficult to put together a didactic teaching on the resurrection body basically from anecdotal evidence. But one thing we can see, and those are the things that you actually observed in your question, you mentioned that he could seemingly pass through physical barriers and ascend into heaven and things like that. And yet, at the same time, he was able to eat physical food and be touched. He told people, touch me, see, a spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see me have. it's obvious that the body Jesus presented to the disciples after his resurrection was the same body, but somehow changed, that had gone into the tomb. The reason for this is because there were still holes in the hands and the feet, which were scars from what had occurred to his body during his lifetime when he was crucified. Also, the fact that the tomb was empty and the body was gone indicates that, you know, this was in the same body. If this was a new body entirely, you know, constructed separately, then his old body could still be in the tomb and he could be in his new one. But this was his old body, come back anew, come back glorified, transformed. So the transformation of the body in the resurrection is what we anticipate ourselves for our own bodies. And it is seen in the first fruits of the resurrection, which is Christ himself. Now, I'm going to just make a speculation here that the reason that Jesus could appear and disappear after his resurrection, but could also eat food and be touched and be handled as a physical person, is that his glorified body apparently had the power to materialize and dematerialize. Now, I don't know what that means. I mean, we have science fiction like Star Trek, where people are, you know, transported to a planet by dematerializing and then rematerializing at the other end. That's science fiction, but it is not something that science fiction writers have been unable to imagine, and it's not something we are unable to imagine. God is able to do that. God is able to give us bodies that can dematerialize. It hasn't happened yet, but it will in the resurrection, it would seem. So that Jesus could materialize in the room where the doors were locked, he could be handled as a material body, and then he could dematerialize and just vanish from their presence. It would appear that it was his physical body that went up into the sky and vanished into the clouds, but he went into heaven, which is, as I understand it, a spiritual realm, not a physical realm. God dwells there, and angels dwell there, and they are all spirits. God is a spirit, the angels are spirits, and I think Jesus probably, his body may have dematerialized when he went up to heaven and you know, was sat down at the right hand of God. I don't think he probably has his material body at the moment, but I could be wrong. Nobody knows. Anyone who claims to know is claiming far more than what we're told in Scripture. And we are here in mysteries far above our head and above our pay grade, so that we don't really know for sure. But my speculative answer to you is that the glorified body is capable of dematerializing and materializing again. And that is the phenomenon that we see occurring with Jesus in his body after his resurrection. That'd be my best way to answer you, Don. I don't know if that's a perfect answer or not, but it's the best I can do from the material we have. We also have a question from Scott. And I'm going to take his question also, because we're waiting for your calls. If you'd like to be on the program, you can call me at 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Well, I'm going to hold off on Scott's question because Ron from West Hills has called in now, and we're going to talk to him, and we'll get to Scott if there's another break. Ron, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning, Steve. Merry Christmas again.
Thank you.
Mike, I just have a question. I just kind of want your opinion because I was listening to some teaching on Jacob, you know, in the Old Testament, and all the teaching I've heard through the years is everyone says, well, you know, Jacob, he stole the birthright and he stole the blessing, you see, because, and that was his name, you know, he was named that way. But I'm wondering if, I don't see that God ever rebuked him and said, well, you shouldn't have that birthright or you shouldn't have that blessing that he received. And I'm just wondering if God knew that his mother would do what she did to help him to deceive the father, and he knew that Jacob was going to get the blessing and the birthright the way he did, and God never seemed to say that it was illegitimate. Go ahead.
Good point. Yeah. We say he stole the birthright, but that's seen it from Esau's point of view. Esau sees it as a theft, but Esau wasn't seeing clearly. Esau had sold it to him. Of course, he sold it to him at a bargain basement price, but he didn't have to. We remember the birthright transferred to Jacob by an agreement made between Jacob and Esau. Esau came in from hunting. Jacob was cooking. He had some lentil stew there. Esau said, give me some of that lentil stew. And Jacob said, I'll tell you what, I'll trade it in for your birthright. Now, I have to admit, that's not a very gracious way for a brother to be toward his brother. Say, listen, I'm not going to feed you, though you're starving to death, or at least you're very hungry and famished. I'm not going to feed you unless you give me something of great value for it. I mean, Jacob should have been more brotherly, but he didn't steal anything. He made an agreement. You give me your birthright, and I'll give you the soup. Esau said, fine. It's a trade, you know. So it was fair and square, traded. And therefore, the birthright belonged to Jacob. Let's just say he wasn't very admirable in the way he got it, but he certainly didn't steal it. This was done by mutual agreement between himself and Esau. Esau had the birthright by being the firstborn, and he traded away the birthright benefits to his younger brother, Jacob. Now, it's interesting, you know, of course God didn't ever rebuke Jacob for that, because Jacob, actually Esau, is rebuked in a sense in Hebrews, because it tells us that Esau didn't value the birthright, that he was a profane person who traded away his birthright for a mere pot of soup. And this suggests that Esau was a man of the flesh who cared more about, you know, carnal things, like having a meal when you're hungry, than he did about spiritual things, because the birthright had to do with being the one who would bring through your family the Messiah and blessing to all the nations in the world. The fulfillment of the Abrahamic promises would be through the one with the birthright, and Jacob valued that. I'm not saying Jacob was a spiritual man. He does not appear to have been a spiritual man at this point in his life, but he at least valued the birthright, which was a thing of real value. Esau, who possessed the birthright, did not value it. And didn't value it as much as he valued a pot of soup. And so it's clear that Jacob, at least, was in one sense being commendable in putting some value on this sacred birthright of the Abrahamic family, which Esau didn't care about. And although Jacob wasn't very, I mean, if a good brother should have simply given the food to his hungry brother, but the fact that Jacob didn't do that, we can scold him for when we see him, assuming we will see him. But the point here is that he did value the birthright where Esau didn't, and that is counted in the New Testament as something that's a reproach on Esau, not on Jacob. Now, later on, when he took the blessing from his father certainly must have known, and if his father didn't know, then Esau certainly knew, that birthright had been traded away. And this was many years later when Isaac, the father, was blind, and wanted to bless Esau with the patriarchal blessing, which really belonged that went along with the birthright. And Esau was told, go fetch me some food, I'll eat it, and then I'll give you the blessing. Now, Esau should have said, well, Dad, I certainly appreciate that, but in all fairness, that blessing now belongs to Jacob. I sold him the birthright many years ago, and it's technically his. But Esau didn't tell Isaac that. And he could have, and should have. But I'm suspicious that Isaac himself even knew that. I mean, this is a major transaction in the family, and it seems hardly likely that Jacob would never have mentioned it to his parents in all the years intervening. So I'm thinking that both Isaac and Esau were in the wrong to try to give the blessing to Esau. Now, Jacob, again, doesn't act commendably in that he deceives his father. He and his mother conspired to deceive the father and to get that blessing for Jacob. But again, it's not a theft. It's taking what was rightfully his. Esau had relinquished any right to it and given it to Jacob many years earlier. So in order to counteract Isaac's wrong behavior in wanting to give it to Esau, his favorite son, there was a deception done by Rebekah and Jacob, and you know, shame on them for being so deceptive. They should have just confronted Isaac and said, now, Isaac, this is something that's already been dealt with between Jacob and Esau, and Esau does not deserve this family blessing. Apparently, they felt that Isaac would not be open to this. Again, speaking wrongly, speaking of Isaac being in the wrong, I should say. So anyway, whether they deceived him or not, we can be critical of the deception. The truth is that the way things turned out, Jacob got exactly what he deserved, what he had bargained for. Esau got exactly what he had bargained for. So no one was ripped off. We can say that Rhode Island or something was sold by the Native Americans for a bunch of beads to the settlers, we say, boy, we ripped them off. But the truth is, those beads apparently were worth it to them. I mean, if people say, yeah, that makes sense to me, I'll take those beads, you can take this piece of land. I mean, we might think, what a bargain basement price that was. But if it wasn't done through deception, if it was done by open transaction, if I come to you and say, I'll buy that car in your driveway there for $50, and you say, sure, what good is it to me? And I take it and I fix it up and it's a nice car. You might say, well, you ripped me off. You only gave me $50 for that car. Well, that's not a ripoff. It's just a bargain. And that's what Jacob had done with the birthright. He had bargained for the birthright. He came out on top in that deal. Now, by the way, we have to remember that God had predicted to Rebecca when both of those boys were twins in her womb. God had told Rebecca that the older would serve the younger. And now Jacob was the younger, which means that the older would serve him, which would mean that the younger would end up with the birthright, because that would be the ramifications of birthright. The one with the birthright is served by his siblings. So God had already predicted that Jacob would end up with the birthright, although he was the second born. But in the bargaining between him and Esau, it came to Jacob fair and square, and there was no theft involved.
Oh, okay.
All right.
In Genesis 27, 36, it does say that when Esau found he had lost his blessing, he did complain to his father that Jacob had supplanted him, cheated him twice. So apparently it was a thing that was known by the family in Genesis 27, 36.
I think so.
And one more thing I just want to say is a lot of times I hear preachers saying, well, Jacob just should have waited. And I could never for myself understand how when Esau was going to be getting the blessing, what he was going to be waiting for. How was God going to do it another
way?
Well,
we'll never know because Jacob and Rebekah took matters into their own hands. We don't know how God might have intervened. God could have convicted Isaac and said, you can't do that, But we don't know what would have happened. Ron, I need to take another call. We only have a few minutes left, but I do appreciate your call today. God bless you. Bye now. Gifford from Rancho Cucamonga. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Good to hear from you, brother.
Good morning, Steve. It's good to talk to you. I got a short question. From the preterist point of view, Matthew 24, is it totally dealing with 70 A.D., or is some of it dealing with 70 A.D. and some of it dealing with the future?
Well, when we say from the preterist point of view, there's more than one preterist point of view, but there are many preterists, maybe most, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if this would be most or just many. They believe the entire chapter. They believe the entire chapter is about 70 A.D. Now, I'm not among them. I actually hold another view. But there are many preterists who believe that the entirety of Matthew 24 is related to what happened in A.D. 70. I myself feel there's two events that are conflated in Matthew's account, and they are from two different discourses of Jesus. We see them as separate discourses in Luke. One of them is, of course, the Olivet Discourse in Luke 21, which is about 70 A.D., and the other is found in Luke 17, and some think that's about 70 A.D., but I also think that's about the end of the world. I think that's about the second coming of Christ in the future. Now, what Matthew has done, he's taken the discourse in the latter part of Luke 17 and the discourse in Luke 21, which are separate discourses given to separate audiences and I think on separate subjects, and Matthew has conflated them in Matthew 24, so we've got both subjects addressed there. Now, this is not that Matthew made a mistake. It's that Matthew commonly did this kind of thing. He typically, in his gospel, combines Jesus' teachings in topical arrangements. And so since both of these discourses speak about future and judgment and so forth, he simply relates them together, as he does in some of the other passages in Matthew where he combines material that Jesus gave on various occasions. But the point of change, I think, takes place at verse 36, actually 35 and 36. Now, again, many preterists would not see it the way I'm saying it. Many preterists think this whole chapter goes on 70 AD. But Jesus says in verse 34, assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away until all these things are fulfilled. Now, all these things would most naturally be understood to mean all the things he said up to that point. So I say everything before verse 34 is probably about 70 A.D. But then in verse 35, he says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows. Now notice he gives a time frame for the fall of Jerusalem. He says, this generation will not pass. But now when it comes to when heaven and earth will pass away, which is, didn't happen in 70 A.D. And is not related to the fall of Jerusalem, but is related to the future, second coming of Christ, he says, now no one knows that day and hour. He basically disclaims knowledge of the timing of the time when the heavens and the earth will pass. But he knows with certainty that the destruction of Jerusalem will be in that generation. So he gives, I think he has two different subjects. One is about the fall of Jerusalem, which is up to verse 34. And then verse 35 mentions heaven and earth passing away, and that becomes a transition point by which Matthew introduces material from a different discourse of Jesus, which is found in Luke 17. He talks about the days of Noah and things like that, which I take to be a reference to the future second coming of Jesus at the end of the world. Now, there is a section in the earlier part that many people think must be about the second coming of Christ, and that's in verses 29 through 31, where Jesus says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven and all the tribes of the earth shall mourn, and so forth. Most people think this must necessarily be about the second coming of Jesus. And it could be, but it does fall within the section where Jesus says these things will happen in this generation. And it's very easy to see that all the language of that little section I just read is apocalyptic language and has parallels in the Old Testament about things that are not about the end of the world, but about earthly judgments. I can't go into that in detail right now, but my simple answer is I think up to verse 34, it's about 70 A.D. After that, I think not. I appreciate your call, Gifford, but as you know, we're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. You can hear the program again, and another program of it, at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. We are listener-supported. Check out our website, thenarrowpath.com, and listen to us again this afternoon. And have a great Christmas. Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
Thanks for listening to The Narrow Path right here on KBRite. I'm Rob Newton. I want to remind you, next week is the last week of the year, and it's also the last week that Steve Gregg will be live at 9:30 in the morning. In case you didn't hear, The Narrow Path has moved to 2 p.m. So it's already there. So today you can get your questions answered at 2 from Steve Gregg, but starting in the new year, he will only be on at 2 o'clock. Be sure to visit his website, thenarrowpath.com. And you can learn more about Steve Gregg and the books that he has written that can help you further dive into the Word of God. And stay with us this morning. Enjoying Everyday Life with Joyce Meyer is coming up next. I'm Rob Newton.
KBRite.
Proudly keeping Christ in Christmas.
You've got questions? We've got answers on the new Bible Answer Show with Michael Lance.
When you're thinking about how God moves in the world, we would call that when he intervenes in the world, wouldn't we say that's a miracle, right? When he actually intervenes, and he often just lets us live with the consequences of our decisions. So there's a tension always between divine sovereignty and human choice, but I think that tension, we just have to kind of leave it there sometimes. But I also think the general way the world works is that God just lets us choose and live with the consequences.
That's the new Bible Answer Show, taking your call-in questions live every weekday at noon, right here on KBRite.
Covering L.A., Orange, San Diego, and San Bernardino counties, Southern California's largest Christian station. This is KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa, KNSN San Diego, 100.7 in Corona, and San Diego's 103.3.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled Living on Purpose for a Purpose. You only get one life. What are you doing with yours? Many times it's easy to lose focus and lose sight of God's plan. In this series, Joyce will be sharing on how to bring peace and joy to your everyday busy life. From personal experience, she wants to encourage you to overcome adversity and seize every opportunity. It's true, life can be hectic, but you can learn simple ways to make each day count and take charge of your life. But before she begins, we want to give you the opportunity to bring joy to someone's heart this Christmas through our Hand of Hope gift catalog. To find out what you can do, visit our website at joycemeyer.org/Christmas. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, Living on Purpose for a Purpose.
If you're not living a productive life, don't blame it on your circumstances, other people, the way the world is today, or anything else. We have been given a free will by God, and that means we can make choices in literally every single area of our lives. You don't have to be a victim to anything. You can make choices. If you don't like the way things are going in your life, right now is the time to make a change. Can anybody here think of anything?